Okay, I'm going to start. It's already 9 o'clock. So again, you can send in your comments, but I'm going to speak for about 50 minutes, let's say, and then I'll get to the comments unless I see something which is really important. We're picking up exactly where we left off, and there's a number of important things we're going to do today. Let me just pick up where we left off. That Rabbi, I want to put a book underneath here. Hold on. Actually, the book I'm going to use to hold my notes. I don't know if any of you have seen this book. This is the whole book is a picture book of Rav Avadia Yosef and his life. With all sorts of interesting stuff in here. Picture of Rabbi Soloveitchik and, full of interesting pictures. Well, when I do, Rav Avadia Yosef the early years, I'll tell you what I learned from this book. I just picked it up last week in Flatbush. No, this book does not have an approbation by him, but it's definitely the families involved. There was a kollel in Kovno that Rav Yitzchak Chanan was very involved with. He was its official head. It was founded in 1877 by Rav Yisrael Salanter, who received the money. There was a Berlin philanthropist named Ovadia Lachman. And he gave a lot of money to the East European yeshivas. He gave the money for this kollel. Now, in a little book published in 1890, about a decade, more than a decade after the kollel was founded, Rabbi Reines' son, Moshe Reines, writes that the idea of a kollel, or a yeshiva of Prushim, they were called, comes from Rabbi Reines. And he describes how his father was preaching about the need for a kollel, especially yeshiva, for those intending to become rabbis. Listen to this. The kollel in Kovno was the exact opposite of the kollel we speak of today. The idea of the kollel in Kovno was to train people to become rabbis. Practical halakha, areas which traditionally the people in yeshivas did not study. That is the exact opposite of the point of a kollel today, where it's about studying Torah for the sake of studying Torah. If you want to get the best exposition of this, look in Rabbi Soloveitchik's Halachic Man, where the whole point of Torah study is not for practical application. That's those people who need to enter out into the world. So it's like you're a professor of medicine, but you have to then become a practicing doctor. But that was not the point of the kollel in Kovno. It was designed for those men who were going to take rabbinic positions and needed to know practical halakha. This institute in Kovno, which was devoted to the study of practical halakha, was the only such place in all of Lithuania. This was the approach, by the way, in Hungarian yeshivas. They were oriented to practical halakha, the Sephardic world, but not in Lithuania. Obviously, there were plenty of yeshivas and other places, but only in the kollel was the Tor, the Beit Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch, were these, you know, primary focus of study. And this was after people had already studied for many years in the yeshiva. Yes, and I will come back, put all the questions you want, at the end, it's probably best, people have emailed me, it's best, I'll go through all of them, and as always, I'll stay on as long as you want. Now, another difference is that this kollel did not have a building. We think of today of kollels having a building. When we say the kollel of Kovno, we mean the students. They studied in different Batei Midrash. There was different Batei Midrash around the city. And they would study. They would study on their own, that's what they did. It was an independent sort of thing. It did not have a Rosh Yeshiva. It did not have Mashkichim. It just was what you call these group of people who were supported to prepare for study. And being that they were close to Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan Spector, they would go ask him their questions, and he would eventually give them Smicha, etc. The students had complete freedom to study what they wanted, but the Smicha they were given was on Yoredeya, all aspects of Yoredeya, and also including the laws of Nida and Mikvah, because of course, if you were in the city, you'd need to decide these questions. And when you were ready, you'd come to Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan, and he would give you smicha. Before Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan gave more smicha to anyone, I think, in the world. Rabbi Soloveitchik, they say, what, 2,000 smichas? I don't know exact. So he is really the greatest Rosh Yeshiva of the 20th century in terms of smicha awarded. Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan will give smicha, and it's known that his smicha, by the way, was not a difficult smicha. People would come from all over and get smicha from Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan. So just because you see someone has smicha from him, there were great people who had it, and then there were average people who had it. But, of course, you would go to Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan and get your smicha after studying there. But before that, you had to get the smicha of the Rav of Slobodka. His name was Rav Moshe Donashevsky. If you know any Donashevskys, I went to high school with the Donashevsky. They're all related to Rav Moshe Donashevsky. Slobodka was a separate town right over the bridge from Kovno, but it always had great rabbis. Rav Yitzchak Hanan and his son is Tzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz. We will get to in a future class. Let me just explain. We're on class number 5 of Rav Yitzchak Hanan. I think we'll probably have about 7 classes of him. We had 8 classes for the Chassam Sofer, 6, I think, for Chaim Ozer. These big figures, it takes us a while. I don't want to rush it. The smaller figures we do, for those people who are new, we usually do in 2 classes. But as you can see, if you've already been with us, we cover all sorts of areas, not just related to the figure we're looking at. However, Rabinowitz and Rav Yitzchak Hanan were not involved in the day-to-day functioning of the kollel. That there was other people. There's a man named Avraham Schenker and Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, soon to found the great Slobodka Yeshiva. He was involved in the kollel. He was even working in the kollel when he founded the Slobodka Yeshiva. And the yeshiva, the kollel students would also hear Musar from Rav Yitzchak Blazer and Rav Naftali Amsterdam, two great Musar figures who were very much involved later with Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel and his endeavors. Because Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel was involved in the kollel, you had Musar being given to these guys, which shows you already that Rav Yitzchak Hanan and even Tzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz were not really opposed to Musar, at least at this time. Later on, Rav Yitzchak Hanan does not have such a positive view, and Tzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz becomes an opponent of Musar. But at this early date, they were not yet opponents. Tzvi Hirsch Rabinowitz is chosen as Rav in Latvia, and who takes his place? None other than Rav Yitzchak Blazer, who we mentioned is just one of these great Musar figures. There were 3 great students of Yisrael Salanter, Rav Naftali Amsterdam, Rav Yitzchak Blazer, and Rav Simcha Zissel. And if you look in this 3DH, Volume 4, you have amazing stories of Rabbi Weinberg's relationship to Amsterdam, Naftali Amsterdam, and Yitzchak Blazer. But he also mentioned Simcha Zissel. And again, the fact that Rav Yitzchak Hanan is president, and Rav Yitzchak Blazer becomes, secondary administrator, or secondary president, or vice president, this shows again that Rav Yitzchak Hanan was not really opposed to Musar, as would later happen, at least for his son. Now, Rav Yitzchak Blazer had earlier been Rav in St. Petersburg. And while there, he came into contact and dispute with this man. We mentioned last class how in places like Kovno and also Vilna, you had religious maskilim. Maskilim who were very observant, but you also had in Lithuania maskilim who were not observant and were anti-observant. And here is one of them, one of the greatest, Yehuda Leib Gordon Yalag, one of the greatest poets. Just, if you take a look at, here's someone who, they went to Cheder and everything, but after that, it's really all self-taught. He never went to really yeshiva for any length of time. He never went to any real yeshiva at all, if memory serves. And if you look at what him and his colleagues could do with the Hebrew language, it is simply incredible. But he is a maskil, an anti-religious maskil. He was in Tells, where he had a girls' school. He also was in Shavami. He's known as an opponent to the rabbis in particular because one of his most famous poems, Mikotzel Shel Yud, from the tip of a yud, it's about a story of a woman, a young woman who is declared an aguna because the get her husband wrote was posseled by the rav of the town because there was a little extra jot on the letter, that's the Kotzel Shel Yud, and this evil rabbi who doesn't feel the pain of the woman, what's his name? His name in the story is Vafsi, with a vav, Vafsi Hakuzari. Those are the letters of Yosef Zachariah. Yosef Zachariah, meaning Yosef Zachariah Stern, who was the Rav of Shavli, which was the city that Yehuda Leib Gordon lived in for a time. So Yosef Zachariah Stern, who is regarded as the greatest Bucky, the greatest erudition, the Ovad Yosef of his day, the greatest Bucky, the greatest wide, Bucky means encompassing, wide encompassing knowledge of anyone in his generation. Just take a look at his writings. That's the one who Yalah goes after. And it's very ironic, because if you look at Yosef Zecharia Stern's writings, he has no hesitation in quoting Maskilim, religious Maskilim. He himself can be regarded as one of these people who was friendly towards Haskalah, a sort of a posseg, a great posseg, but who's very friendly to Maskilim and Haskalah, even more close to Maskilim Haskalah viewpoints than people like Rav Yisrael Chanan and the Netziv and the rest of them, who are also friendly. So, as I said, it's ironic that he, who's the most open-minded of all the great authorities in Lithuania, he's the one who's attacked. But, of course, from Yalak's standpoint, the fact that he's open-minded doesn't mean anything. He still is a traditionalist rabbi, and he makes him the villain. Yosef Zecharia Stern, in his day, and he lived into the early 20th century, he towered over so many others. He was one of the greatest figures of his generation, entirely forgotten today. I remember when I learned in the Kollel in Boston, once when I lived there, I mentioned I had a new Sefer. He just published in those days one of his new volumes of Tshuvot, edited by Simcha Fishbein, if the name means anything to you. He's American. He wrote a book on the Mishnah Brura. And I brought it to the Kollel, and I showed it to the my chavrusa. It was a typical Lakewood guy for many years. He had never heard of Yosef Zecharia Stern, which, obviously he didn't have a lot of knowledge of Jewish books, but the fact that he is someone who's been in yeshiva his whole life, and here is someone, Yosef Zecharia Stern, who 100 generations ago towered over everyone, and he's totally forgotten today because he's not part of the canon in the Lithuanian yeshiva world. I tried to explain to this guy that Yosef Zecharia Stern is not just some rabbi that you find a sefer of his from 100 years ago, that he is he'd be one of the greatest sages of the generation, and he didn't believe me what I was telling him. Because he never heard of him, you know, their canon is so small. But that's Yalag. Now, we know that when Yitzhak Blazer was the Rav in St. Petersburg, remember, the people living in St. Petersburg were all special people. They had exemptions to live inside the Pale of Settlement. They were wealthy, or there was other reasons. The average person couldn't go there. My step-grandfather, who I mentioned in the past, the one come from the Chabad background, Rav Zevin, Nava Zipkov, he would go with his father. They used to get special permission to go be Chazan in St. Petersburg for the high holidays, but they were only given, let's say, you can only be there 2 weeks, and then you had to go back outside the Pale of Settlement. Yalag thought, that's Yehuda Leib Gordon, thought that Yitzhak Blazer had embezzled community money when he was in St. Petersburg. That is, he was the rabbi of the city. He was not the crown rabbi. There was a crown rabbi, but he was the spiritual rabbi. He thought that he embezzled money. And according to Jacob Mazza, who was the crown rabbi, I'm confused now. Was he crown rabbi in St. Petersburg or in Moscow? I'll have to check it. I think he was crown rabbi of, I think he was crown rabbi of St. Petersburg and later moved to Moscow. Maybe one of you can check it. Jacob Mazza. He wrote a wonderful memoir. He reports that if he wasn't crown rabbi there, he was there for a while. He was in St. Petersburg, Moscow. Boris is Moscow, but he spent a lot of time in St. Petersburg. He reports that when Yitzhak Blazer got up once on Shavuos to recite Akdamos, this is what Yalag, as a joke, screamed out. Migu de chashira mamona chashira shvuasa. If you're not trustworthy, this is from the Gemara in Bava Metzia, which doesn't accept this principle. He says, if you're suspect of fraud in money matters, you're suspect of swearing falsely. He's making a mockery, basically, of Blazer. And he would continue to make such comments, and the people would laugh at them. Basically, they're making fun of Yitzhak Blazer. The community in St. Petersburg was a fairly modern community, as you can imagine. Mazza refers to other problems the two of them had. Once Blazer made a stink about burying this irreligious Maskil next to the Orthodox Jews. He wanted to put the Maskil in a separate cemetery. Separate part of the cemetery. And Yalag protested, saying that only God can determine who's a bigger tzaddik, or who's a tzaddik and who's a rasha, and that Blaser has no business. And Blaser wasn't able to make these decisions on his own. The community leaders had to go along with it. Gordon Yanlag was a big reason, maybe the primary reason, why Blaser leaves Moscow. Because Gordon, he wasn't just an individual, he was the secretary. He was on the community payroll. He was the communal secretary, so he could give Blaser lots of tsaris. In fact, Yalag is later put in prison by the Tsarist officials on the charge of counter-revolution. And Maza states that this came about because Blaser's followers informed on Yalag. So after 16 years, Rabbi Yitzchak Blaser leaves this position. He didn't want any more rabbinic positions. This is before, and he never took another rabbinic position. Before he comes to Kovno and assumes the role I mentioned, he had an inn, and he rented out rooms. He divorced his first wife after she couldn't have any children. Today, we don't do this. I mean, the idea that the Gemara speaks, but already in medieval times, the notion that you're supposed to divorce your first wife after 10 years, if she doesn't have children, and marry a second wife, who does this anymore? No one does it, and you'd be thought to be cruel, but there were people who did this. But as I said, no one's done this in a very long time. There's responses that justify it, because by not taking a second wife, you are saying that you can't fulfill the first mitzvah of the Torah, Pur Revu. So it's not a simple thing, but I think you see here an example of how romance and the idea that husband and wife are really a unit, which is the message of Genesis, the beginning. Husband and wife become one unit, and today especially, the idea of polygamy is we would never do something like that. So that's the idea of Pru Urvu is sort of pushed aside in favor of communal familial harmony. There's a story, which I've asked some Chabadniks, and they say it's a completely false story, but maybe, I don't know. I've heard it said that the Lubavitcher Rebbe divorced his wife and remarried her the same day, so that he followed the idea that you get divorced, but he remarried her. Like I said, I've asked certain Chabadniks, including not real Chabad people, old-time Chabad people, and they say it's a completely false story. But be that as it may. He then marries a widow. That is, Blaser marries a widow, and they had children together. She also had her own children. One of his stepsons, that is, one of the children of the widow he married, was Rav Moshe Shatzkus. Those who went to YU, I don't think any of us listening here remember Rav Moshe Shatzkus, although it's possible there are some. He was the Lamja Rav. And right after the war, he comes to America, and he becomes one of the Rosh Yeshiva YU, one of the people involved in Smicha, a great, great Torah sage. But I do believe, maybe Bill's, I don't know, Bill, if you, it's before your time, but there was his son, he had a son, first of all, Rosh Shatzkus had a son who was a Rosh Yeshiva, and he had a grandson, Jerry Shatzkus, who whenever I go to London and speak at the Ner Yisrael show, I mean, he basically... There is a show in London called Ner Israel, which was founded by Jerry Shatzkus, American. He married an English woman, Pamela Shatzkus, who's written on Jewish history during the Holocaust period. And he didn't like any of the synagogues in England. We're going to speak about English synagogues in just a minute. So what did he do? He opened his own show, which is an American-style show, which Rabbi Alan Kimchi, rabbi there. So those who went to YU certainly know the name Shatzkus. And this Rav Moshe Shatzkus was raised by the great Rabbi Yitzchak Blaser. Blaser's first wife, by the way, goes to Eretz Yisrael and dies at a ripe old age. And I'll get to all the questions soon. Shimon, I'll get to your points in a minute. At the end. These are all interesting things. Let me tell you, I hear all these questions and comments. And the class here is at a very high level, but this is a very difficult class because there are people listening right now who know all sorts of things that I don't know about, and there are plenty of things that they know that I much more than I know. At least I hope that what I speak about now, I know more than they know. But as I've said many times, what I learned from the comments and questions, it's sort of like to be a rabbi in a shul where you have full of musmachim and full of people who are Bikim and Shas and Poskim. I have people who are experts in so many different areas and I am very grateful for the comments and questions and the things you point out my mistakes, and it's an honor that you think I have what to listen to you. What to give to you. Oh, let's go on, though. Oh, before I go on, I forgot to mention this at the beginning. Yisrael Kashkin, who's listening to us right now, he's been with us since the very beginning. He had this article in the latest edition. Can you see it here? My Long, Lonely Journey to the Rav. I recommend everyone who's interested in Rabbi Soloveitchik to read it. If I can send you a PDF of it, Yisrael can send you a PDF. It's a story of someone, and this, I think, resonates with many people who listen, who started out later, Yisrael, but plenty of people started out in a more Haredi background, and the problems in that world, and how he found his way to the Rav, and how Rabbi Soloveitchik speaks to him, and speaks to so many others. So it's a very personal reflection, and I recommend it to all. Yisrael also pointed out to me that I was a little outdated. Last week I mentioned the Web Yeshiva, Torah and Motions competition, that I said it's very expensive, and he points out that, and I checked that he's 100% right, that now they learned that you can't really charge, so it is free, but they sort of don't have the classes we have, so that's all I can say. Getting back to Yitzhak Blazer. So he becomes, after this inn he had, he becomes head of the Kollel in Kovno, really, Ritz Hanan is the figurehead. And this institution was not liked by the Maskilim. And once again, just like in St. Petersburg, they set their sights on Rabbi Yitzhak Blazer. They couldn't criticize Rabbi Yitzhak Hanan, even if they wanted to. And they didn't want to. Again, they blamed everything that was bad on the underlings. Yeah, we mentioned Yaakov Lifshitz, Yitzhak Blazer. They accused him of financial corruption, of misleading Rabbi Yitzhak Hanan. And also, they thought he was a fanatic, and he was influencing the students in a fanatical sort of way. Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan was forced to respond in the Haskalah publication, Hamelitz, which was one of the big Haskalah newspapers, stating that he had full confidence in Rabbi Yitzhak Blazer. And he get rid of Yalag for a minute. We'll put up some more things in a few minutes. But the controversy was too much, and Rabbi Yitzhak Blazer leaves the Kollel. He eventually goes to Eretz Yisrael. The son-in-law of Rabbi Yitzhak Hanan, his name was Soltovsky, he succeeds him, Soltovsky. And he was only an administrator, was not a rabbinic figure at all. I just mentioned that the Maskilim opposed Rabbi Yitzhak Blazer, but we know that there were many in Kovno that liked him. How do I say that? Because when Rabbi Yitzhak Hanan died, there was a movement to make him Rav of Kovno. But this failed, and Ritzi Hirsch Rabinowitz, his son, was appointed successor. Now, getting back to the Kollel, he was not successor for that long. Money was raised all over Europe for this Kollel. And even Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch wrote a letter about this, and you can find this in Etkes' book on Rousseau Salanter, page 294. Shimshon Raphael Hirsch writes a letter for Avram Schenker, who was the administrator for a time, in which he says in this letter that that this Kollel Prushim trains its people, those studying there, for Torah and secular studies. And therefore Hirsch is very excited, and he writes a letter asking people to give money to this Kollel in Kovno that's encouraging its students not just to do Torah, but Torah in Derech Eretz. Where could Hirsch possibly get this idea? Etkes concludes, and must be correct, that in the effort to raise money, Rabbi Schenker did not resort to the most upright means, and he misled Hirsch. Hirsch didn't invent this on his own. Schenker must have told him or applied to him that the students were being educated in the German Orthodox approach, which was not true at all. It's not the first example we have of misleading to make money. In my book, which I just completed, I quote examples there of rabbis who claim that when you're raising money for yeshivas and kollels, you can say there's more people in it than there are. You can mislead in all sorts of ways. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes he doesn't know where they get a heter to lie about these things. Like, let's say you have 30 students, let's say you have 100 students. But he's asked this question, and he says there are people who do it, and I don't know where they get the permission. But the fact that there people do it shows you that this idea of misrepresenting the truth in order to raise money, and it has a long tradition, and I have I have some examples that are completely shocking and go against the grain so much today. I don't want to reveal them now because I want people to be surprised, but stay tuned. This kollel existed until World War II. Incidentally, Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan also signed a letter asking people to contribute to Israel Hildesheimer's Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan Spector, who was on very good terms and respected Israel Hildesheimer, thought that the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin was a great institution. And he writes in this letter how we have Russian students who go there. It's a great institution in Western Europe. He doesn't want it in Eastern Europe, but for Western Europe, it's wonderful, and he encourages people all over the world, including in Russia, to contribute to it. Rav Chaim Ozer, in our class, as you recall, had the exact same perspective on it, that it's great, but not great here, just great in Western Europe. Now, I said that Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan was the greatest posek in his day, in the Ashkenazic world, with questions sent to him from all over the world. His Be'er Yitzchak, one of his volumes of response that was published when he was 41, and there are 18 responsa in it about Aguna. In other words, rabbis were asking this young scholar, younger than me, younger than most of us listening, or any of us, to decide the most difficult questions of Jewish law. And he was known, as I already mentioned, I just want to return to this for one other point, he was known as a great mekil, a great lenient posek. For just to give you other examples, in addition to what I already did, he agreed that missing limbs count as evidence in freeing an aguna. That is, but it depends how much. He says you can't, if you can't make out a person's face, but for example, the person's missing an arm, and it's the right height, things like that, that's enough. That's enough to free an aguna. But, he didn't permit teeth, by the way. If you're missing teeth, that's not enough. He did permit remarriage if you find three items on the body that belong to a dead man. There's three separate items. That also would be enough. But just because he was the Gadol Hadar or the Posek Hadar in his era in the Ashkenazic world didn't mean that everyone accepted his position on every matter. And now I'm going to talk about a huge kashrus dispute, which is forgotten today by most people, but has all sorts of relevance. So I think to the kashrus world as we live in it today, and also just for all the Jewish history matters. And I'm going to mention in regard to this new book that just came out, The Legacy, Beryl Wein and Warren Goldstein, Teachings for Life from the Great Lithuanian Rabbis. Fortunately, now that I do things on the Sfarim blog, there are two separate publishers that send me all the books that they publish. One of them is Magid Books, because they want me to give plugs online. So I'll tell you why this is relevant in a minute. There was a big kashrus controversy in London. We spoke a bit about the London community in the past. Let me briefly tell you what happened. You had the East European Jews there. I'm not going to go into the details, which we dealt with already, but they did not accept the old-fashioned English rabbinate, and they didn't accept the kashrus under the supervision of the chief rabbi of England and his Beis Din. Even though his Beis Din was run by East European Talmidei Chachamim, they did not accept the kashrus there. And they didn't like the chief rabbi, who really was contemptuous of the East European Jews, and they couldn't relate to these synagogues with top hats and choirs, and they wanted East European Judaism. And as I said, we're not going to go into details because we spoke about that. But the issue, in addition to not trusting the chief rabbinate to begin with, there was one issue in particular that had been going on for a long time in London and continues until World War II. And that is that the London Beis Din allowed butchers to sell hindquarter meat. Let me show you here what I'm talking about. Here is... We eat the front of it. This is the back of it. We don't eat this. In order for, and you have here sirloin, you have tenderloin, you have top sirloin, filet mignon. In America, this is not eaten. It can be eaten, though, halakhically. There's something called nikor. The word in English is porge. P-O-R-G-E. This is the word you read about, how the meat has to be torched, but which means you remove, well, I'll talk about what you remove in a minute. But that's not an English, that's an English word, and I'm looking at a dictionary here. What does it mean? And look it up. To make a slaughtered animal ceremonially clean by removal of the forbidden fat, veins, sinews, according to Jewish ritual. In other words, the English word porge, P-O-R-G-E, is only used with reference to this meat core. The origin is it's a Judeo-Spanish word from purge. And if you tell people porge, and in London they used to have porgers, whose job it was to do this, no one was going to know what you're talking about, because it's not part of the English language, other than the fact that it has a Jewish connotation. Now, so you would come into a butcher shop, and this is the end of the 19th century in London. This had been going on now for decades, and they were selling all types of meat. You bought the front of the meat, you took it home and koshered it. You bought the hindquarters of the meat, you would have to take it to a man. There were certain people in London called porgers, and they would take care of the meat for you. And yet, we know that many Jews in London were not so pious, not so observant. You had in those days what today we would call the non-observant Orthodox. That's one of the great advantages of London, the United Synagogue. Although most people were not observant, the institutions were Orthodox. But many of these people would come to the butcher, they take the meat, and they take it home and eat it. They didn't get it porged. They thought it was just, you know, that's some stringency. Maybe they thought that's like Glock kosher or something. And for the East European rabbis, the East European community in London, this was akin to selling treif. And they demanded that the sale of hindquarter meat not be sold, and they would not participate, and they would not go to any butcher which was selling non-kosher meat. This is their propaganda, that non-kosher meat was being sold. It was leaf neiver, you're placing something right before the blind, and non-kosher meat was being sold. Well, from the standpoint of the chief rabbi, what do you mean non-kosher meat was being sold? Same thing with the front part of it. You have to kosher it. If people choose not to do that, that's their problem. And the truth is that this is how it was. If you could tell someone now, that go up to someone and tell them that butchers in London under the authority of the chief rabbi were selling non-kosher meat, people would say that's impossible, that's outrageous, but the meat is non-kosher before it's porged. But for that matter, and I confirm this with a few different people, including Bill who's with us, whose father's a shofet, all the meat in America until the 1970s was, quote, non-kosher in every butcher shop. What do I mean by that? Because someone of you can correct me if I'm wrong, was there any butcher shop that sold kosher meat? Or was this chicken, from what I've been able to determine, my mother and others remember, that was already sold, that was taken care of. But my recollection as a young child and people I've asked is that you'd have to take the meats and you'd have to kosher them yourself. That is, it's not like today where they took care of it for you, they salted it and all that. And from the chief rabbinate's perspective, this is the exact same thing. You're buying meat. It was clear to everyone that the meat would need to be, couldn't be eaten the way it was. It needed to be either koshered or needed to be porged. But that was not what the East European Jews said. I mean, this idea that it relates to things today, because we would never give hashgacha today anymore on a butcher, which doesn't give the meat, you know, ready to eat. For that matter, we give hashgachas today, would never give hashgachas unless all sorts of things, which are not halachic really, are taken care of. For example, when I was in Flatbush, two Shabbases ago, it was Arab Shabbos, I went into one of the Dunkin' Donuts there, kosher Dunkin' Donuts. We just got one in my town. Actually, I just went in to compare the prices. The prices were not the same, but there's a sign on the wall, and this, I've seen this in many kosher restaurants and kosher places. In accordance with kosher regulations, no outside food can be brought in. Well, why not? What does this have to do with anything? If I were to, there's Dunkin' Donuts there that sells donuts and sells coffee. If I were to bring in food, even if I were to bring in a salami sandwich, a tray salami sandwich, what does that have to do with the Dunkin' Donuts? Well, why? I mean, it doesn't have nothing to do with it. The food's the food. But this is policy. So kosher organizations have a lot about policy, and there can be big disputes on policy. If you look at, there was a dispute between Rav Avadi Yosef and Mrs. Eliezer. If I were to tell someone in America that there's a hashkacha given on a restaurant that serves milk and meat products, not just serving meat, milk right after meat, but serves milk products cold together with meat. That is, I order a hot dog, and then they bring out, and they give me at the same time milk together with it. You would say, impossible. It is impossible to give a hashkacha on such a product. And yet, Rav Avad Yosef says, if asked, you have to give a hashkacha to such a restaurant. And Rav Tzitzel says, absolutely not. And Rav Moshe Feinstein basically agrees with this in asking to Mexico. Rav Avad Yosef says that there's different levels of hashkachas. This is obviously not Mahadrin, but if you don't give a hashkacha, then they're going to have treif meat. And at least if you give a hashkacha, you know the meat they eat is kosher. And if someone wants to get milk and eat it with the meat, that's not the restaurant's responsibility. And that it's not hot milk and hot meat, and that's not your responsibility. And, you know, what he does, it's no different than if you go into a supermarket and you buy a piece of cheese and a salami and put it together. And Rav Moshe was asked the same question by Rav Avigdor in Mexico about the JCC there, the sports club that they were going to open on Shabbos, and the restaurants, you know, they're going to serve non-kosher and kosher together. And you could imagine, and he said, you know, you can do that. So you see already that it's not so clear, these areas. So getting back to the case with hindquarters. Even though, according to Halakha, we can eat the hindquarters. Anyone who says you can't eat it, it's not true. We can eat it. However, we don't eat it in this country. It's pretty rare outside of Israel to find hindquarters, because it's difficult to take out. It's very skilled. You have to be very skilled to take out the fat, the arteries, the sciatic nerve. But throughout history, this was done. And Jews were able to enjoy parts of a cow they don't today, filet mignon, sirloin, and tenderloin. It's true that in much of the Ashkenazic world, it's been a long time, not just centuries in many places, where they didn't do it, because it was thought to be so difficult, and you don't want to make a mistake. But if necessary, it would be done. In the 1930s, Rafael Moser Brzezinski said that we should do Nikor, because there was all sorts of pressure on Shlita, and non-Jews were no longer buying the hindquarters, which meant that the Jews were losing all this money. And if the Jews did not, you know, use the hindquarters, the anti-Semites would claim that Jews are wasting meat, and they would push to ban it in Poland, where Vilna was part of Poland. There was a huge push to ban Shlita. In Madrid, I was in Madrid a month and a half ago. Well, first let me say there, you can get hindquarters in Israel. And when I was in Israel also a month and a half ago, I went to, because I was preparing these classes, I went to El Gaucho. So I had sirloin. I didn't like it so much. I like regular, I'm not such a steak eater anyway. I don't know, there's one place in America where you can get it, but I don't know, any of the standard butcher shops in Williamsburg or anything. And in Europe, I really haven't seen it either, with one exception. Madrid. In Madrid, in the butcher shop, there was a sign in Hebrew, attesting to the fact that the menaker, the one who does nikor, has been tested, and, you can eat the hindquarter meat. And that's a Sephardic community. But then I go down south, and there's two small communities in the south of Spain, not in that kind of Gibraltar. One is Malaga, about 100 Jews, and the other is a place called Torremolinos, which is about 100 Jews also, which has a wonderful restaurant. I hope it's still around, God willing, when I pick my group. And the two rabbis of those communities, I don't know how they support them, but there's two rabbis there. Well, it's not really a full-time job, because they also do Shlita. And this shlita is exported to Gibraltar, and the shlita, you have it at the butcher there, which is connected to the restaurant. You have a sign from the London based in attesting to how reliable the butcher is. And that's, they do not do nikor in the south of Spain, but they do it in central Spain. I can't resist telling you this before I go on. Here you have a community of 100 Jews, how do they support a kosher restaurant and a very nice kosher restaurant? They support it in Torremolinos because in the summer you have a lot of tourists there, and even in the winter I saw, you know, religious tourists there. But I'm walking to the restaurant, and there's a nice community there with a rabbi and a shul. It's a little nothing of a place. It's just a resort. As I'm walking there, I see a building, a restaurant. It's closed now, but it has a big sign in the window. Shabbos. Not Shabbat. Shabbos. I feel like the Ashkenazi. Cholent Kiddush after davening. And then it says, Beit Yosef Glot. This is the only place to get real kosher meat. We do not rely on the rabbi of Torremolinos. His standards do not measure up. Here is a, and I spoke to one of the guys in the city. He said that it's only open in the summer. So here you have a guy. I don't know if it's under any hashkacha. It could be under hashkacha. You can get to in Prague, for example, where I took the group last year and the year before. You have three meat restaurants. One is Chabad, one is under the chief rabbinate, and one is under the Chug Chasam Sofer. So it could be they could bring in someone in from France or England, I don't know. But here you have a community, a tiny little nothing community of 100 people struggling to survive, and you have a separate, completely separate restaurant telling you that only he's reliable and don't go there. And but as I mentioned, so they don't do Nikkor there. So then what do you do about all these places in the United States? I was in Delancey in Passaic, if you have any Passaic people here. And lo and behold, on the menu there, it says kosher tenderloin. If you go online, Glot Kosher, as I did just before, to search, I found two places. One is called Kosher Express. There's a whole group of places that deliver for you. And the Kosher Express advertises tenderloin. So I wrote to them. I see that you have bison hanging tenderloin steaks. Is this real tenderloin? I ask because I am certain that the OU does not give hashkacha to hindquarters. This is from Kosher Express. Thank you for reaching out to the Kosher Express. In regards to your inquiry, the hanging tenderloin cut comes from the flank of the animal and is in the forequarters. So it's not real tenderloin. And then there's something called Park East Kosher, which also advertises online ground beef tenderloin. So I wrote to them. Kosher, this is a reply. Kosher tenderloin comes from the front rib section of the cow. The eye of the rib area is cut out, which is also used for kosher filet mignon steak. So in other words, you can't go to any non-kosher restaurant, a non-kosher place, and tell them that what they serve you in a kosher restaurant is really tenderloin. But just like glot doesn't mean glot, it means whatever they say it means, so too in kosher restaurants, tenderloin means whatever they tell you it means, tenderloin. But there is one place in America where you can get tenderloin, sirloin, filet mignon, and that is, and as I'm speaking, any of you can go online to Bisra Kosher, BISRAKosher.com. And I found out about this because there's someone in my community who only eats meat from organic, grass-fed meats and all these sorts of things, so he gets from there. And you can go to the website, and there's a whole description how he does Nikkor, and that's great. And I would love to get it, but let me tell you about a bit of a problem, I think. Who runs this website? Who does the Hashkach Shlita? His name is Rabbi Avigan Elkin. Sure, a wonderful person, very reliable. If he invited me over to his house and served me all that meat, I'd be happy to eat it. He teaches at YU in the Chinah program. He's on the based in of Elizabeth, I'm reading his biography here. He writes Gittin for them. He's on the he's rabbi now of this Sephardic shul in the Upper West Side. Great. The only problem is, if you look on the website, who gives the hashkacha? He gives the hashkacha. So here you automatically have a problem, a conflict of interest. How can you have a situation where the guy who's giving the hashkacha is also the shochet and also the one selling it? It's an immediate conflict of interest. Even if not intentional, because, whatever he doesn't sell, As kosher, he can maybe sell a non-kosher, but it's not the same money. So there's a reason why we insist that not the shochet is not the mashkiach. You need someone else. Now, I understand that in previous days, things could have been different. And that you would have in cities that were basically the rabbi maybe was technically the under. The shochet would have to show the rabbi the knife and everything, but the shochet shechted it and sold it. But we haven't done that in a long time, and we're living in an era where even people, we saw what happened in Muncie. So I think it's very problematic. Now, I mentioned, maybe I shouldn't be saying that, because in a sense I violated also. In Prague, I mentioned a third restaurant. The third restaurant in Prague is the Chabad restaurant. Do you know who gives hashgacha on the Chabad restaurant? The Chabad rabbi. And it's a restaurant. So, and we had inns throughout the past. People eat at inns. You can rely on the proprietor. But it just seems to me there's something different than an inn. And obviously there's something different when you eat at someone's house. And I even think there's something different with a restaurant. When the Chabad is having a restaurant, I think, maybe I mean, there isn't. But the problem with Rabbi Elkin is that I understand why he doesn't have, because today in America, the big hashgacha organizations won't give hashgacha to Nikor. But am I wrong? I'll read your comments later. I don't see how you can buy from a shochet when the shochet is the mashkiach and has a financial interest in it, because even subconsciously, Chas HaShalom, I'm not assuming you do something like what happened in Muncie, but subconsciously, it just seems to me it's a problem. Eating at his house is not a problem. Of course you can eat at his house. You can shech for yourself, and anyone can eat. But as a profit motive, in today's day and age, but those who don't agree with what I'm saying, and those who want to buy, or if you want to buy organic, you can go to his website. It's a very nice website. He gives a whole description of Nikor, and why today Ashkenazim, you know, he talks about that there's no real Masorah anymore for the Ashkenazim, and I wish him the best. Now, according to the Ramah, you can only, Moshe Isserles, you can only learn Nikor from a teacher. That's why if you looked at the letters that the rabbis during the era of the Nazi era, they wanted to learn Nikor, they had to go to Italy. Because there was no one else who was teaching Nikor at that time. And let's get back to England, by the way, with this Machokas. By the way, already in the days of the Shulchan Aruch, there were communities that didn't do Nikor. This is mentioned by both the Radbaz and Rav Menachem Mendel Krochma. Rav Menachem Mendel Krochma is the first Tzemach Tzedek. He wrote the Responsa. And anyone who comes on my trip this summer, I will take you to Nicholsburg, and you will see Rav Menachem Mendel Krochma's grave. They would sell their hindquarters to non-Jews. That's what they did. And Modna, Leon Modna, from Venice, Yehudei Aryeh Modna, whose tombstone I'll also show you if you come with me this summer to Italy, to Venice, he mentions that in many places in Germany and Italy, they didn't need hindquarters, although the rest of the place they did. So this, I'm just mentioning this so you know that this idea that we don't eat hindquarters, this tradition not to eat hindquarters, it's not some new chumrah like glot or anything like that. This is an old tradition. But in the land of Israel, they did do Nikor. They never stopped. As far as I know, they never stopped doing Nikor, and they continue to do it there. In fact, the Rav Chaim Vital mentions that the Ari told him that you should eat the hindquarters if Nikor was done. And we know in Prague they did Nikor. And the Aruch HaShulchan, that's not ancient history. The Aruch HaShulchan tells us that in Nevardik, his city, they did Nikor. They had specially trained Menachri. So returning to London. And I'll go for 5 more minutes. And then I'll take the questions and comments. The chief rabbi refused to adopt any of the suggestions. You know, the East European rabbis and they wanted him to get rid of the selling of the hindquarter meats, or at the very least, you put in porgers in every butcher shop. He didn't listen to them, and he referred to them, quote, as people who came over here uncultivated and uncivilized. This is what the chief rabbi of England, I should have showed you a picture. I'll pull up a picture. Next week I'll get a picture of him for you. Herman Adler. He used to dress with, look like an Anglican, he's a Talmud Chacham, but he dressed in that Anglican garb. And he had, as I mentioned, contempt for the East Europeans. And this is what people do when they, this is the first thing breakaway communities do, wherever they are, open up their own shlita. remember in the classes we dealt with, or Tzipesa Frank, or Fry Moser, and others, how the Eda Haredim in Jerusalem, they open their own shechita, the Hasidim, their own shechita. That's a sign to show you don't accept the rabbi, he's not reliable enough for you, so you get your own shechita, and then you're a separate community. Because if you say that you don't trust the hashgacha or the shechita that's under the rabbi of the city, you're saying he's not a reliable rabbi. And you can't use him as a rabbi. And how do you illustrate that? By saying your shechita is not reliable. So they brought over a rav, the East European Jews. It was called Machziki Hadas. They had a big shul there. And it's more of a shul. It's all ethos, a community. He had been rav in Telz. And in 1891, when they brought him over, he was the rav of Helsinki in Finland. They just appointed now a YCT graduate as rabbi of Helsinki. I'm going to pull up a picture of him in a minute, Rabbi Werner. Unlike other, he was a Zionist, Rabbi Werner. Here is a picture of him at the Zionist convention. Here you have, this is Arthur Cohen from Basel. It's an old rabbinic family. I've spoken about Basel a few times. They have old minhagim there. It goes back to the mid-19th century. I mentioned to you that the chief rabbi Basel commented once that, today we've gotten rid of the repetitions and davening and everything, but not in Basel. Basel, this is the minhag. They repeat words. The chazan repeats words, and that's the minhag now for well over 100-some years, 130 years. You're not going to change that. It's not like our communities. Here is Rabbi Werner, head of the East European Rabbonim. He is Rav Shmuel Yaakov Rabinowitz, one of the great early religious Zionist leaders, and here is Rav Pinchas Rozovsky. He never abandoned Zionism, by the way. So many of those who were at the Zionist Congress in Basel later would turn from Zionism, would abandon Zionism. The editor of the newspaper Hapelis, and later Hamodia, Rav Eliel Kiva Rabinowitz, who becomes a leading anti-Zionist, used to be a Zionist. Rav Yehuda Leib Tzirelson, who we mentioned was head of the Hegudas of Yisrael in later years. Many of these people, although they remained lovers of Zion, left Zionism because of the secularism that was so significant to it, or the non-religious leadership. Rabbi Werner never leaves it. In 1911, he's interviewed and states that he remains a Zionist, even though the leaders of Zionism are a disappointment. So the Machziki Hadas under Rabbi Werner opens its own shechita, which is, as I said, really, it's like shooting a cannon across the bow of the chief rabbinate. Until now, you had one shechita, one community, and here you open up a separate one, saying your shechita is not reliable. All great machlokeses and Jews begin with the shechita controversy. We spoke how Rav Tzipias Frank wrote to Rav Chaim Moser Rozinski asking him to declare invalid the whole Eda Haredit and everything, and one of the big issues was the Shlita. One of the first Shochtim of the Machziki Hadas was a man by the name of Moshe Yitzchak Siegel, later to be Rabbi Moshe Yitzchak Siegel, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Manchester Yeshiva, gave smicha to many of the important rabbis in England, including Louis Jacobs. I can send you a copy of the smicha if you're interested. His son, I guess it's his son, who became Rosh Yeshiva in Manchester, after him. Stay tuned for my Sfarim blog post next week, where I have some interesting stuff about Rabbi Siegel. We go for two more minutes. So what do you do when one of these breakaway communities opens up their own shlita? Traditional path is you declare the shlita treif. Remember the Ridbaz classes we had, the big machokas, the Ridbaz in Chicago? You declare, they declare his shlita treif, he declares their shlita treif. The rav of the community, and that's exactly what they did, the Beis Din, declares the shlita treif. I always wonder when you hear things, what do you mean it's treif? It's treif in a sociological sense. It's not really treif. The Shochtim were Torah people, religious Jews, it was under the Hashkacha, even though it's a machokas, but the Rabbi Werner's a reliable Rav. So when the London based and Rabbi Adler say they declare it treif, what they mean is in the communal sense, you can't eat it, we regard it as treif. I can't imagine that even them, they, who were so opposed to Werner, would say that if you ate it, you have to kosher your dishes or anything. Everyone knows that the meat is per se kosher, but it's akin to, for example, when the Satmar hung the Lubavitcher Rebbe in effigy in the 1970s. Until then, technically it wasn't the Satmar, here it was the Malachim, that extremist sect in Williamsburg. But it was done in Williamsburg, and the Crown Heights Beis Din declares that you can no longer eat the Shechita of Satmar. They're not saying that it's treif in the sense that it's actually non-kosher. It was that incident, incidentally, that allowed David Elliott Poultry, my former landlord in Scranton, to become a big shlita. Before then, it was a very small shlita, but when Crown Heights abandoned Williamsburg, they transferred their allegiance to David Elliott Poultry. And until today, David Elliott Poultry is the real manufacturer for some of the Crown Heights based and for Chabad families. But, and this is where we're going to end, and I'll take the questions. For the East European Jews, simply getting a psak from the Chief Rabbi of England and getting a psak from his Dayani, that's not enough. If they want to shut down the Shlita, you need to get a psak from the Gadol Hador. What we will see next class is, unbelievably, the Gadol Hador, the Posseg Hador, Rizochon Inspector, also declares the Shlita completely invalid. And nevertheless, remember what I said, that even though he was the Posseg Hador, not everyone listened to him? Rav Werner and his followers, and they had many others on their side, reject Rav Yitzchak Inspector and basically tell him, mind your own business. So if you think that the great Rav Yitzchak Inspector, anything he said was listened to, we'll see that's not the case. So we're going to do that next class. We will then move into the Heter Mechira. Rav Yitzchak Inspector, probably the most influential psak of his day, also creates an enormous dispute, not just with other rabbis of Europe, but with rabbis in the land of Israel. A lot more to say as well. It's 5 of, but let me, there's a lot of questions and comments. I'm going to go through all of them with you, listen to all your comments. Those who just want to hear the class is over. If you want to hear more comments and questions, I'm going to go through, not everything, but I'll start. So Gershon points out that the kolos of the Hasidim were in halacha. Yes, that's the tradition of the Hasidim. Asuke Shmaitata, Aliba de Hilchasa. In the Lithuanian world, Rav Tuvia Goldstein. I know two people who worked with him. One of them, by the way, is Rabbi Avram Lieberman, if we have anyone from Los Angeles, who used to be a Shalamis, who moved out to, out to Los Angeles. He is one of the students of Rav Tuvia Goldstein. If you look at this, Sefer he published as Haskama, Rav Tuvia Goldstein had a small yeshiva called Emek Halacha, which was, he claimed at least, it was the only Ashkenazi yeshiva devoted to the study of practical halacha. Let me see. I've lost many of the comments on top. I think we have so many comments. So I'm going to keep going down. You write them in. You can look up. You see the first comment I have is something from Gershon. So let me keep going down. You can type in. Yecheskel mentions that Rav Chanan Leibowitz of Chofetz Chaim could not have kids. Okay, I'm not sure what that related to. Shimon says, when they wanted to move to Berlin Seminary Eretz Yisrael, they saw how much the Europeans liked it. Yeah, we, in the class of Chaim Moser, we dealt with that. Shimon points out that the rabbis were opposed to Malicha in the house because, to koshering in the house because they thought this is should be done at the home. This is a, something about the traditional Jewish way. And it's true that selling it today after salting is a new thing. But today, you need to do that because otherwise people won't, how many people buy meat in the butcher? They're not really that observant. They just want kosher meat. And they don't know how to salt or anything, so. Look, I don't know about Leanne about unbroiled liver. I don't buy it. I don't know. Leon says that numerous kosher supermarkets still sell liver unbroiled. You're right. If that's the case, I don't know the difference. And Shimon tells us, I think he's writing from Jerusalem, that you still buy it and you salt it yourself. You could buy it from Bistro Kosher and do it yourself also, but I have not been, tell me if I'm wrong, to any of the stores in New York, in New Jersey, where the meat is not ready. Baruch says they still teach you how to kosher a chicken. I don't know why you need to kosher a chicken, because can you ever buy it where it's not koshered? I don't know. Shimon points out that Nikor is much more difficult. You can't do it on your own. No one did Nikor on their own, though. But there were people, there were special people in London who you'd bring it to, and they would take care of it. Yes. Okay, Marbella. There's a Chabad rabbi in Marbella, but they don't have anything really in Marbella. Would you have it in Malaga, which is not far? And Gibraltar's not far. That's where you get the kosher. There's even a little kollel in Malaga, but the restaurant, then you have a kosher food store, but the restaurant is in Torremolinos. Meiselman Chaim asks, why do people single out the OU for meat products? I don't know what you mean by single out. The OU does meat. It was when the OU went glatt, then the modern Orthodox community was brought along with it. If the OU was still doing regular kosher, you'd still have the modern Orthodox community eating regular. No, people eat? Oh, meaning people don't eat? I don't know. I don't know where you live. Where I live, everyone eats OU. The Star K was the problem. There was a time when people didn't eat Star K. And Rav Moshe Sternbach even said you can't eat Star K. He's not reliable about Moshe Heinemann. But OU, in fact, all the OU meats have a lot of different hashkafas on it. Are there any OU meats that don't have, like, two other hashkafas on it? Malta, no, I'm not thinking of a tour to Malta, because there is some Jewish history in Malta, by the way. You had Jews, you had the Knights of Malta would kidnap these people going to the land of Israel, and they'd leave them on the island there, and then they'd ransom them. And you had all sorts of Jews whose job it was to ransom those Jews who were kidnapped and kept on Malta. The Italian Jews took it upon themselves as Pidyon Shvuyim to ransom the Jews who were on Malta. So the Jews were in better shape than the other people who didn't have people. You know, the typical Christian, no one's ransoming him. Chaim Meiselman asks, don't Hashkafa tell him to take a piece of the profit? Hashkafas are paid. They too have a vested interest, obviously, because if the Hashkafa makes it too difficult, if the OU makes it too difficult, then they'll can the OU and they'll bring in the Chafkei. Or when I was living on the west side years ago, apparently the local Vod was making too much of a problem, so they brought in the Vod of Flatbush. I think this was called the Flatbush Vod. Or you always can do that. In Brooklyn, you have your choice. So, yes, so they do have a vested interest as well. But I think it's a little different than because it doesn't go to the individual. You know, the OU has a vested interest, but it's not like any individual is getting the profits. But if you yourself are selling the meat and you're the mashkiach on it, it creates a problem. Now, granted, take the Muncie case. Our whole kosher system relies upon Shomer Shabbos. We don't have mashkichim in all day. We can't in these places. We rely on the fact that the owner is Shomer Shabbos. And that doesn't change even if you have a menubal like the guy in Muncie. But the guy in Muncie had a vested interest. He makes more money if he sells treif, but you can't throw out all the principles we have in the Shulchan Aruch because you have people like this. But I'm just saying, it seems to me, at least, it doesn't pass the smell test that in today's day and age, you're going to have a guy giving the hashgacha to the meat he's shechting for profit. Because that's my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong. It could be I'm totally inconsistent because what's the difference? If you have the butcher, and you rely on him versus the mashgiach, versus the shochet, you're relying on him. And they used to rely on the shochet years ago. I mean, if the shochet was trained, he'd chef, and he'd be the bodek, and he'd sell it, and I don't know. What you had was, in many places, that the shochet shechted it. He'd be checked by the rabbi, you know, if he hadn't knew how to shecht it, and then he'd prepare it, and he'd sell it. So the shochet was acting like the butcher. 100%, that's what they used to do. Chabad in Prague is, let's see, it is dairy, yes, it is dairy, but I don't know if that's, why is that an issue in terms of, here we're going to a place, and I went there, I didn't bring my group there, but I went there, and everyone goes there, where the Chabad rabbi is, it's his restaurant, he makes money on it. This isn't like you're paying, it's not like you're paying for Shabbos meals when you're coming. This is a regular restaurant, and it supports him, his family, and his endeavors there. And he is the mashgiach. One of the mashgiachim who works for the Chul Chasam Sofer said to me, basically, I don't know how people could eat there. There's no hashgacha. There's no mashgiach. Well, there is a hashgacha. There's the Lubavitch. And when people used to go to inns all the time in Europe, you'd go to an inn, there was no mashgiach. You trust the proprietor. I told you how I worked in Simcha by the Sea. Rabbi Newhouse. He never had a mashgiach. Rebbetzin Cutler and Rebbetzin Schwartzman used to come every Shabbos. You trusted Rabbi Newhouse. He was making money on it, but you trusted him. So according to strict halacha, you don't need a mashgiach. And according to strict halacha, we don't need a mashgiach for bistro kosher either. I'm simply saying that today it seems like problematic. Yes, subconsciously everyone gets paid. You're right, Yoili, we have no choice. Unless you turn the hashgacha business into a non-profit endeavor, which the community of Kehillah sends out as a non-profit and gives hashgacha, there's no choice. So what else are you going to do? No, and see, they get paid where they kash the meter apostle. The problem is Yoili's right. If they apostle too much, they're going to get rid of them. Don't you remember the machokas they had a few years ago? Oh, when they got rid of, I think, the OU and they brought the OK in. You have these things all the time. And it works the other way also. It's not just the owner. The hashkachas can create doubt when there is no doubt in order to benefit themselves. We have people on this who are listening now who were in Long Island a few years ago, when the Vod of Long Island, based upon nothing, cast aspersions on Ramosha Soloveitchik's hashgacha on Streitz Matzah that has been in the Soloveitchik family for two generations. And they did it, and what this led to was the Chafkei having to be brought in, and Motzi Shemra and everything, based on nothing. So if you want to destroy someone's business, if you want to make sure that you get part of the action, all you have to do is cast aspersions. So it works both ways. Yes, Avadia points out that Rav Nachman Okrachmal dealt with Aguna's questions. There's a lot to say about Rav Nachman Okrachmal. If this class is going in 20 years, maybe we'll get there. This is not Ranach. This is not Nachman Okrachmal. And I don't know if they're related. There's no evidence, but they probably are. The first Tzemach Tzedek, not the Chabad, the first one was Rav Nachman Okrachmal. He was the Rav in Nicholsburg, which meant that he was the Rav in Moravia. A great Torah scholar, important responsa. You can see the Sefer on HebrewBooks.org, I'm sure. And he's buried in Nicholsburg. Nicholsburg today is called Nikolov. A few more questions. Yes, Yechezkel, I thought of that when you said that. The Cohen family is an old family in Basel. If anyone's wife or mother, or I don't know the ages we have here, daughter, went to Machon Gold, of blessed memory. Machon Gold, when I went to Israel, there was only one real American yeshiva, BMT, and there was Kotel, Gush, and Shalvim, and KBY were the only other yeshivas in the country. And for the girls, you had Michala, and really just Machon Gold, named after Zev Gold, who signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence, the head of Mizrahi, one of the heads of Mizrahi, rabbi in Scranton, Pennsylvania, where I'm sitting right now. Also rabbi in Williamsburg, one of the founders of Yeshiva Torah Vadas. It's called Torah Vadas because it's named after Rabbi Reines' yeshiva in Lida. Vadas means secular studies. I don't think they remember that anymore at Torah Vadas. Torah Vadas means Torah Umada. But Rabbi Machon Gold, Gabi Cohen, for years, was the dean of Machon Gold. This is a great-grandson of the Rabbi Arthur Cohen, who you see in the picture right now. The family, beginning in the 1940s, was very close to Rabbi Yechiyak of Weinberg when he comes to Switzerland. A few other things. Meiselman asks, what about the Shmashach declaring Lubavitch Shlita Treif? That, I think, is not just sociological. That, I think, he probably assumes it really is treif, because the person shechting it is a heretic. No one took that seriously, other than maybe David Berger. I mean, the okay is Chabad, you have plenty of Chabad shochtim that, and all the other groups. But that, I think, is different. If a sectarian group, if a group of Hasidim decides that they want to be firmer and open up their own shechita, and the Rav of the city declares it treif, I mean, in what sense is it treif? I mean, the Shochet is a pious Jew. So that's, these were just issues over politics. What it means, though, is it's treif in the sociological sense, and if you have allegiance to the rabbi, you wouldn't dare give any money to that shlita. You wouldn't dare have anything to do with it. That's, I think, what it means. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's been my experience. Would the Haredi community consider Cholavei Shochting if there are any treif? There is one Cholavei guy who is a Shochet. Would they consider him treif? I don't know. You'd have to ask them. I think it would depend on the guy. Yoeli says Satmar was considered treif, and I'm repeating all this for people who are listening who are not going to listen live. Satmar was considered treif to the sense of non-kosher by the Kashai Rav. Okay. Okay, we're getting reports here that some of them really think it's treif, but I'll ask you, Gershom. If you have one Satmar Rebbe, who says about the other Satmar Rebbe that the people who follow him, the meat isn't treif, I ask you again, does he really believe it's treif? If he tells you to clean your, to kosher your dishes, does he really believe it? Or is he just saying it as part of the politics? Because whatever, you're in the community, so I don't know. MTJ has a kolah focusing on halacha. Volozhin also created a kolah later, had a kolah focusing on halacha. I did not know that I'm writing this down, Avadia. I did not know that Rav Tuvia Goldstein ever published responsa. Rav Moshe Feinstein mentions him in his chumas. They lived, I think, in the same building even. Lost me for an instant. Something happened there. Okay, let me just quickly look. I assume you can hear me. I just popped on again. Okay, look, there's so much here. I'm not going to be able to get into it all. I'll say take 5 more minutes. Shimon points out that the Chosam Sofer disputes the Chovos Levavos, who said that you have to learn just Halacha Maisa. Shimon, what the Chosam Sofer is criticizing there is not the Chovos Levavos. Is criticizing the idea that people would learn crazy Shilas, and that's what the Chosam Sofer is speaking about. Although the Chosam Sofer, what you say about the Chosam Sofer is correct, but the Chovos Levavos was, the Chovos Levavos was specifically referring to, he calls it, I think, a Sheila Zara or something like that. A from Maskil Yecheskel is a Maskil, someone who's open-minded and everything, but who's a religious Jew, who's a Shomer Shabbos, who respects rabbis. Baruch says that in Lakewood and others, there are Litvaks with a focus on learning. I think what Rav Tuvia said is the only yeshiva with the focus on it. You always had chaburas, you always had people focusing on learning. You have people learning rabbis. But at least the students said this is the only yeshiva, that is the whole yeshiva. We're not dealing with a chabura or a yeshiva that has certain people learning it. Supposedly, well, I heard this from one of his students. He said that they took pride in being the only yeshiva which was devoted. Whether that's true or not in America, I can't say. We get a report that you can buy on 13th Avenue in Borough Park meat that's not kosher. So Bill tells us that the missing yud was the word Hillel spent chaser. I need to look at it. I don't remember, but thank you. So it's not a letter, it's a missing letter. I think Rav Tuvia Goldstein responds to Avadi. I think he learned when he was young. Did he ever learn in Baranovich? I don't know, I could be wrong. Okay, so many very learned people here. We are told where Rav Tovia Goldstein got the idea of practical halacha. Avadia tells us that there was a Rabbi Abu Lafia who wanted to be chief rabbi in Malta. I don't know. As far as I know, there are no Jews in Malta. I guess maybe there's some Israelis there now, but I don't know what, there's no historical community, so I don't know. Simcha by the Sea, I was a waiter. All the Dov Schwartzman came there once, many other great rabbis, the Feinstein family came there, they all ate there, and there was no hashkacha. Except when the Satmar used to come, they would bring their own mashkiach. Okay, getting to the end here. Baruch said the 5 pounds vod said they do it to stop questionable private hashkach sharing. That's exactly what they said. But the problem is, who said Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's hechsher was questionable? We have a picture of Aaron Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the rest of them. This hashkach has been accepted by everyone, and they can just throw out this this aspersion. They don't have to say, they never said what the problem is, they just said that we have questions about this hashkach. They never investigated it, they never spoke to people, they just threw it out. So you destroy a person's livelihood, and especially if you know about Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, if you know in his personal life what he has suffered, and to just throw this sort of thing out, it was the lowest of the low. There's a tshuva in the Tzitz Eliezer about the case of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's son. Please send that to me, Ovadia. I can't. I'm not going to write it down. Oh, I'll write it down. I'll take a look at it. I will look at it. Now I know people took it seriously about Shach, but I'm saying in America, who took it seriously? You can't. How can you take it seriously? You can't then eat. I'm not talking about eating at Deli Kozba in New York, which is sort of like a messianic. Front or a messianic center where you eat there, you watch the Rebbe putting on tefillin and shaking his lulav. I'm talking about how can you take it seriously because the OU and the OK and even the Hamish Ashkachas often used Chabad Mashkichim and Chabad Shochtim. So how can you take it seriously? That's the point. If you ask David Berger, he was able to determine which ones were reliable. So that's what I mean. When I brought David Berger once to Scranton, he was very mocked at what meat I could serve him and what meat I couldn't. Okay, we're coming to the end. Rabbi Aluf opened this kollel for the Syrians to learn halacha. But that's nothing, that's no, as we say, that's no chiddush, because the Sfaradim always learned. Look in Yabia Omer, look in the introduction to Rav Avadya Yosef, and he tells you that the only proper method of study of Torah is precisely to, learn for practical halacha. So you'd expect the Syrians to do it. When they don't, those Syrians who go to YU, there are a number of them there, they almost all are students of Ben Chaim, and that's the halacha maisa. Okay, so Shimon, thank you for telling me, I remember correctly, he learned in Baranovich, et cetera, et cetera. What does Rav Abadi and Ari Yitzchak speak about? Halacha maisa? I'm not sure. This will be the last question from Shimon. Okay. He himself, even though his whole life has been in the Ashkenazic world, he is a Sfaradi, and he is a Halacha L'maisa person. Very good. Thank you all. Send me if there's any other things I need to end now. I look forward to seeing you all next week. Thank you very much. Enlighten me again that it is not easy saying things with this audience. I know some of them personally, and others I know just through the comments. And but it's great because as it says in Pirkei Avos, you learn most from your students. And at least for this hour, you're my students, and I learn an enormous amount. And not and especially since I have people here just looking at it. We have people in religious Zionist strongholds. We have people in Williamsburg. We have Litvish. We have Satmar. We have everything. So that's great. Thank you all very much, and good night, everyone.